My name is Dick Miller. I teach in philosophy and I direct the program in ethics and public life. This is the last lecture in EPL's spring series on the politics and ethics of the rise of China. It's a series that, above all, was organized for two reasons. One is a reason of hope and participation. People in China are engaged in vitally important discussions of what the rise of China can teach the world about escaping poverty and how the future of a fifth of humanity can be shaped in its governance and in its ethical orientation, coping with some of the problems of China's rise. We wanted Cornell to be part of that vital conversation. But the second big reason was a reason of fear and conflict. For many in the United States, the rise of China is a challenge to the United States, and that challenge is feared as a source of conflict, especially over the long run. These two reasons for organizing the series as a whole make Wang Jisu an ideal final speaker. As a leader in Chinese discussions of China-US relations, and a leading participant in joint discussions with people in the US, Europe, and elsewhere about China's rise in the world, he's famous for two things. On the one hand, he's famous for his clear-sightedness in investigating the sources of conflict that give rise to legitimate fears. On the other hand, he's famous for his humanity in seeking ways to avoid conflict, in seeking ways to find a soft landing in cooperation for humanity as a whole as the US responds to China's rise. Alice Pell, the Vice Provost for International Relations, will now welcome Wang Jisu to Cornell, then Xu Xin of the Government Department, the Director of the China and Asia Pacific Studies Program, will introduce him, and Wang Jisu will speak to us about Beijing's strategic distrust of the United States and its policy implications. Alice?
Well, good afternoon. It's a delight to see this many people here during the last week of class. Maybe people don't want to spend more time in the library. It's a delight to be here today. Wang Jisu is, as Dick mentioned, is the Dean of the School of International Studies and the Director of the Center for International and Strategic Studies at Peking or University or Beidou. That means that he is our landlord because that is where the CAPS program is located. And we very much appreciate the efforts that he's made over the years to allow us to have the CAPS program at Beidou. So thank you very much for all of your support in that. As has been pointed out, his research focus has been on Sino-American relations and the pitfalls in there. It's important to note that Hillary Clinton is in Beijing as we speak, so it's probably a very timely time to have him give us his assessment of what's happening. So I'd like to very much welcome you back to Cornell. It's not your first time here, I know that. And hope that it feels like a familiar place with many familiar faces, and we look forward to your talk today. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Miller, for giving me this privilege to introduce the last speaker as this tremendously successful public lecture series, The Politics and Ethics of the Rise of China. Dick, we all owe you. It's a great pleasure and honor to say a few more words to introduce our distinguished speaker, Professor Wang Jisi. After having the pleasure of hearing from Vice Provost Alice Pell, let me begin by concurring that Professor Wang's tie with Cornell is multifold, academic, institutional, and personal. While he's not a Cornellian himself, he's the father of a Cornellian, and his son Xi Kang studied at Cornell Law School a few years ago. He's also a partner of Cornell at his School of International Studies, is our overseas home, the overseas home of CAPS program at Beida, as it's called in China. Also, he has had many of his students, including a few in the audience and myself, study or work at Cornell. So without exaggeration, Jisi is an honorary member of the Cornell community. As China's preeminent scholar of international relations, indisputable leader of American studies, and the leading foreign policy advisor to political leaders, Professor Wang Jisi is well known and highly respected both in and outside of China. Besides his primary responsibilities as the Dean of the School of International Studies and the founding director of the Center for International and Strategic Studies at Beida, he is currently also a member of Foreign Policy Advisory Committee of the Foreign Ministry of China, President of Chinese Association for American Studies, and a guest professor of National Defense University of the People's Liberation Army. More important, he has frequently briefed China's top leaders on major foreign policy issues for the past two decades. Like many of Chinese of his age, Jisi spent some of his best growth years as Sandong educated youth in the Chinese countryside, working as a farmer and worker in Inner Mongolia and Henan province in 1968 to 1978. He then entered Beida and obtained an MA degree there in 1983. Upon graduation, he started to teach in the Department of International Politics at Beida until 1991. During that period, I was so fortunate to have Professor Wang as a mentor and then a colleague. Intellectually, I was deeply indebted to Professor Wang's vision, insight, and wisdom. At a personal level, our friendship weathered those extraordinary days and nights of Tiananmen Square in 1989 and beyond. Before Professor Wang returned to Beida and assumed the current position there in 2005, he served as Associate Director and then Director of the Institute of American Studies at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences from 1991 to 2005, and concurrently as a Director of the Institute of International Strategic Studies at the Central Party School of the Communist Party of China from 2001 to 2009. Like many prominent intellectuals at this global age, Professor Wang's reach and influence is global. Among many distinguished posts he has held, he has been visiting fellow or visiting professor at Oxford University, University of California at Berkeley, University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, Clement McKenna College in California, and Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. He's also a founding member of the Pacific Council on International Policy in Los Angeles, International Council member of Asia Society in New York City, Advisory Council member of the Center for Northeast Asian Policy Studies of Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and Advisor of Asia Center at Harvard University. And he's also on the editorial boards of the American Interest, Global Asia, Chinese Social Sciences, and many other Chinese scholarly journals. He's currently a global scholar at Princeton University. Professor Wang's scholarly interests cover U.S. foreign policy, Chinese foreign policy, and Asian security. He has published numerous works in those fields. Just last month, he and Kenneth Lieberthal co-authored and published a very important policy paper entitled Addressing U.S.-China Strategic Distrust. So today, at this very last session of the Politics and Ethics of the Rise of China public lecture series, organized masterfully by Professor Dick Miller, we are so delighted and honored to have Wang Jisi as a perfect speaker speak on Beijing's strategic distrust of the United States and its policy implications. Professor Wang, we all look forward to your remarks.
Thank you very much, Xixin, for your fine introduction, which reminds me of what I have done and what I have not done. And also, thank you very much, Dr. Alice Pell and Professor Richard Miller, for your kind arrangements, which will allowing me to do the job today, which is to speak about not a very encouraging subject. I'm extremely privileged and honored to speak to such a distinguished and well-informed audience. I remember, and I was told just a few days ago, my colleagues Jia Qingguo and Guan Guihai came here to substantiate and deepen our cooperation between the two schools, between the two departments. So I'm also very happy to see some of my former students here, including Dr. Xu Xin. They all made contributions to the U.S.-China relationship at personal, political, and societal levels. But this is not a moment for me to congratulate ourselves for what you have achieved. Rather, I think I'm going to speak about a very serious and not so encouraging subject, which is Beijing's strategic distrust of the United States in history and today. I'm not neglecting the positive side, but today I'm not going to talk about the good stories. And you know, arguably, the distrust of Beijing in Beijing of the United States in strategic terms has been deepened rather than lessened. But this is arguably true because Ken Lieberthal and I co-authored a book here, and we emphasize that if this kind of distrust is not dispelled or properly addressed, we might have a confrontation between the United States and China, which might bring about disastrous consequences. But then people say, are the reactions from Beijing and Washington? I'm in Princeton for a month after the release of the report, so I don't know what the action is there in Beijing, but I heard something from Washington, D.C. Some officials were quite happy to see our joint study, but I was told that some leaders and some officials did not want to hear some bad news or bad stories. I assume that is also true in Beijing. So when I talk about Beijing's distrust, I'm not only focusing on those who are dealing with the bilateral relationship today, like the foreign ministry people or the State Department officials. They are working very hard, and they want a more positive interaction between the two governments. But how about those officials who have little to do with the bilateral relationship or little to do with foreign relations as a whole? And that is my focal point. That is, when I say Beijing's distrust, I'm not talking about simply the distrust from the foreign ministry or from those who are dealing with the bilateral relationship. I'm talking more broadly of the body politic in China, including those government agencies who have good reasons to suspect the United States. And then Ken Diebold's and mine worries necessary and warranted. As I just said, some people are not very happy to hear the bad news until, especially when Hillary Clinton is now in Beijing and they are going to be engaging each other on important issues, and the dialogue is called SNDD, Strategic and Economic Dialogue between the two governments. Just a few days ago, I received text messages and phone calls from the Foreign Ministry's news department saying, hey, this is time for you to speak out because we are going to welcome Hillary Clinton and others from the United States, and you should say some good things about U.S.-China relations. In the media, over the website, and receiving TV interviews, and I said, I'm in Princeton, so I cannot join you. But more recently, I'm not avoiding any political sensitive issues. A human rights activist by the name of Chen Guangcheng was seeking diplomatic and consular protection from the U.S. Embassy. And I'm wondering whether the news department, the foreign ministry will call me again to say, well, this is the moment for you to speak about the good things about U.S.-China relations. So that is to say that, the relationship is not depend upon the goodwill of the two sides, especially the goodwill and intentions of the two governments. The relationship nowadays is so complicated. There are so many different actors, different elements that are going to complicate the relationship. So this leads us to focus on the first central theme of the concern in Beijing ever since 1949. I'm talking about the most political sensitive issue, that is what in Chinese eyes the American scheme to sabotage the Communist Party leadership or to undermine the Chinese state power or state authority. And this has been a constant theme since 1949. Virtually in every political campaigns and movement in the PRC, the Chinese see a large shadow of U.S. Interference in China's domestic affairs. In 1956, for instance, there was the Hungarian rebellion, and it alarmed the Chinese leadership to a very large degree. The Chinese were consulting the Soviet leaders and then issued statements against the incident. And privately, the Chinese leadership, in my research in history, the Chinese leadership said privately that the incident, the rebellion, was basically caused by the mistakes committed by the Hungarian communist leadership. But openly, the statement was that the rebellion was caused by, was inflamed by imperialist powers and imperialist designs. So it was a combination of international intervention and domestic trouble in that country. And, make a long story short, those events in Eastern Europe and also the also the political changes in the Soviet Union led to the insecurity on the part of Mao Zedong and some other Chinese political leaders. And that they resulted in the 1957 anti-rightist movement. And then there was the high politics of so-called class struggle, and all the way leading to the Cultural Revolution, culminated in the Cultural Revolution when American lackeys and running dogs were driven out, and the Soviet Union was also overshadowing the Cultural Revolution. So the United States is always in the center of the most sensitive issues in Chinese high politics. In the 1980s, when the relationship was quite good, there was also the political campaign against cultural contamination and also the bourgeois liberalization and so on and so forth. And here, some people here still remember Fang Lizhi, and that he was a leading figure in those moments. And then came 1989, the Tiananmen incident. And it was the conclusion of the Communist Party that Tiananmen was, the incident was inflamed, and the students were encouraged by the US government and by a lot of US people in their personal capacity. And after Tiananmen, there were a lot of other things happening, but Falun Gong rose up in 1999 and beyond. And then along the way, the Dalai Lama is being supported by the United States, both government and Congress and some individuals. And people say the Xinjiang problem was also being used by the US government to embarrass the Chinese. And there are a lot of espionage cases in China that are related to US CIA and other agencies. And most recently, the former police chief in Chongqing, Wang Lijun, went to the US General Consulate for political asylum or whatever. We don't know the details, why he went there. But obviously, he and others saw the United States as China's enemy, or they can take advantage of the contradiction between Washington and Beijing. That's why he sought some kind of political asylum to the U.S. embassy, rather than he didn't go to the Japanese embassy or the Russian, or North Korea's consulate. And also the latest example is Bo Guahua, Bo Xilai's son, who is studying at Harvard University. And this brings to the whole thing of political sensitivity related to the very high politics in Beijing. And this is, I think, the very constant theme in China's distrust of the United States. And this can be very structural. The reason is China is a country led by the Communist Party. And then the Americans say you are a democratic society. And when I say I'm a Communist Party member here, people have are puzzled about who I am, right? So people have different reactions, but generally speaking, a communism or a communist-led country is not well received in this country. And we know that, and you know that, and that, a structural problem. That leads also to some recent repercussions and phenomenon. And the second deep-rooted distrust in Beijing about the United States is also very evident since 1949, since the founding of the People's Republic. That is, the United States is a hegemonic power. And in the past, we call it an imperialist power, trying to dominate the world. From the beginning, the Korean War and then the Vietnam War and all the wars launched or participated in by the United States are seen in China as related to its hegemonic ambitions. It is designed, its intention to dominate the world. This is a power struggle, international power struggle. Even after September 11th, when people in this country say you were fighting against terrorism, international terrorism, strategists in China say, this is an excuse. Because they found Osama bin Laden and they knocked down Iraq. They went to Iraq and they went to Central Asia. They went to Afghanistan to establish their military installations. So it is true that they fear in international terrorism and Osama bin Laden, but they also take this opportunity to dominate the world politically, and they use this as an ideological war against their opponents in the Islamic world and so on. And human rights interventions are always seen by the Chinese as also a policy tool. That was evident in the Kosovo War against Yugoslavia. And today, when the Americans say that they are concerned about the human rights violations in the Middle East, especially in Syria, and so on and so forth, the Chinese say, this is another example of showing how the United States is taking advantage of other countries' domestic problems to achieve its goal. And to put things in this prism, then Syria and Iran and North Korea are put into this category. I mean, the United States Yes, the United States is concerned about nuclear weapons, but is that the true reason? Or do they have some other ulterior motives to demonize the Iranian government, for instance? Is North Korea really threatening the United States? Or the United States is using North Korea's nuclear program as a policy tool against China? These are all the questions the Chinese ask themselves and ask the United States. So there's a deep concern in China that the United States, as the only hegemonic power in the world, is trying to prevent China from rising up, or prevent any country from rising up into a global power. And then you put the two things together. China is a communist country, and China is a rising power. So China probably is the ideal target, and necessary target for the United States. Professor Miller just mentioned there was some fear in the United States. And I think the Chinese even exaggerate the fear to say, we have to guard against this kind of intention to stop China from growing into a global power. And the larger background here is global changes, political changes and economic changes. Especially since 2008, when the financial crisis occurred. In China, people generally see a declining West, not necessarily declining United States, but the United States is leading the Western countries, the Europeans and Japanese, and the United States are leading power. So when your allies are declining, and then you yourself is also declining to some degree, And people also point to a lot of domestic problems in the United States, like political polarization, or financial problems, and the lack of job creation, and so on and so forth. Many other issues in the United States. And China is a rising power, and the United States is generally seen as a declining power, although the leadership is very sober-minded to say, well, wait a moment, the United States is resilient. But they don't say that openly, for good reason, for political correctness reasons, and so on. So, there is a competition between models. Some people say there is a Chinese model, or the China model, versus the U.S. model, Beijing consensus versus Washington consensus. Who represents the tide of the day? Who is on the wrong side of history? Some people say, well, now we see the United States is on the right or wrong side of history. Capitalism is in deep trouble, and if not socialism, at least China is rising, together with some other growing powers, especially India, Russia, Brazil, and South Africa, what we refer to as blocs. So we have a new balance of power in the world, and we have deepened suspicions about the American model. And that goes deeply into China's internal discussion of China's development model that I will refer to in a few moments. If you look at this picture, then it is certain that the United States is trying to contain China. Because China leads the way, because the United States feels the threat, because the United States has the fear. And containing China is a well accepted, widespread belief in China. As a so-called leading scholar in the U.S.-China relationship, I cannot deny that simply by saying, well, the United States is not declining, it is not containing China. There's some element to show that the United States is worried about China. But to say the United States containing China is too simplistic to me, because there are also reasons for optimism, and there's a great deal of cooperation between the two countries. But if you are a realist in international relations, if you see power struggle as inevitable, then you see a rising power status of power competing with each other. And in China's daily life, we say, there cannot be two tigers in the same mountain. Unless there is one male and one female. But China is not a female. So the United States wants to be the male, so the two tigers will have to fight. And then you have reason to believe that the United States is trying very hard to circulate China from India, Pakistan and Afghanistan, of course, troublesome, the United States is walked down there. But look at India, the United States is trying to strengthen military relationship with India. And then Myanmar or Burma, they are trying to encourage political changes there at the expense of China's strategic interest. And then in Southeast Asia, they are taking advantage of China's territorial disputes with Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, and some other countries. And then you go to Taiwan. The United States is sending weapons to Taiwan, and the United States is helping Japan to strengthen its military power, and the target might be China. And in South Korea, the United States is also trying very hard to solidify its security relationship with South Korea, and the target apparently or ostensibly is North Korea, but the ultimate goal must be China. Russia is the only country the United States is not, cannot take advantage of at this moment. But the Americans are also trying to convince the Russians that China might be inevitable challenge. And even in Mongolia, the United States is having some influence at China's expense. So whenever I give a talk in China about the international situation, always people ask the same question. Do we want allies? Do we need allies? Where are all the allies? It's a very good question. And the United States has allies all over the world. Maybe some people say 64 countries have some security relationship, sort of, with the United States. Is North Korea China's ally? Not to me, because we don't sell weapons. We don't give any military aid to North Korea. Is Pakistan our ally? I don't know. We don't have a treaty relationship. And elsewhere, where do we have our allies? Cuba? I don't know. Maybe a political, we have political and ideological affinity, but it is too far away, and Venezuela is another example. So people say, well, we should seek allies. At least we will try to get Russia as our ally. So this kind of mentality is quite an enduring. So to me, paradoxically, China's growing very strong. It's a growing power. It's a stronger power than any time before. So you see a more assertive China in its foreign relations. But do we see a lot of confidence on the part of China with a growing power? That is a question we have to think about. And when China has more power, if it is less confident, where's the problem? I think there are two problems. One is the growing power generates some jealousy, suspicion, some concerns in neighboring countries and worldwide. And this is what you call sometimes security dilemma. Another problem, to be very honest with you, is China's domestic vulnerabilities. And the United States and other powers could take advantage of those vulnerabilities. Or if they don't take those things, then some Chinese are taking advantage of that to make domestic trouble. And that is the first part is political. Second part is international power struggle. The third reason for China to be suspicious of the United States is Taiwan. Also, since 1949, Taiwan is seen, the American support to Taiwan is seen in China as trying to divide China, taking advantage of China's division. And the United States will never welcome a united China. And that's why it is maintaining the so-called unofficial relationship with Taiwan, but they also sell weapons to Taiwan, despite China's constant protest and threaten to use our own ways to punish the United States. Last but not least, economics. And economics, trade relations serve as a bondage between the two countries, a very good way of cooperation, but it also creates frictions, like renminbi evaluation. And on the part of China, there is also a very strong suspicion that the United States will never give up its dollar domination in the financial in the global financial system. So this is a deep-rooted distrust. The United States is the number one economic power, and China is number two. And if the United States grows 2 to 3% a year and China grows at the rate of 7%, 8%, then in a few years, the latest year might be 2030, China would become the greatest economic power in its economic size. What will then the United States do to maintain its supremacy? It's up to you, but I mean, the Chinese are suspicious that the United States will try very hard to maintain its dollar domination. It will never welcome Chinese renminbi as a reserve currency internationally. So when we are going ahead with all the trade relations with other countries, and when we are going to establish renminbi as an international currency, the United States may try to make trouble. For instance, the U.S. now has promoted the idea of trans-Pacific, trans-Pacific partnerships. That is, the United States is going to convince Japan and South Korea to join their device to establish a more viable international linkage between the United States and other Asian countries. They have set up some obstacles for China to join, according to China's leading analysts. So there is also economic competition, although this is not entirely a zero-sum game. And I forgot to mention the military-to-military relationship. It seems more like a zero-sum game. The PLA will never say that we will welcome a stronger U.S. military force. And the U.S. military, Pentagon, hates to say that we welcome a stronger Chinese Navy, Chinese Air Force, Chinese strategic forces, more missiles or more aircraft carriers. And this is a very typical case. I met some Americans who told me that the United States will never become a secondary military power. It will not allow other countries to challenge its military supremacy. But look at the map. The U.S. Starting from from California all the way to across the Pacific, and had its naval establishment in Guam and Japan and army bases in South Korea, and it also has a military relationship with the Philippines and Taiwan. But where is China's navy? Just a coastal navy? Will China be satisfied with that? And China is talking about breaking through to the second island chain and so on and so forth. So it will not be possible to convince the PLA that you should trust the United States' intentions, or you tell the Pentagon people you should trust the PLA. It will never threaten you. So in this sense, I think the problem is also structural. And I don't want to mention that very much, but intelligence communities in both sides depend on the suspicion of the other side for their legitimacy. They have good reasons to suspect each other. So these are the deep-rooted distrust on the part of Beijing. And what are the policy implications? I think there are several things I want to mention. The first is there is increased attention paid to defense and high politics issues. Remember history. From 1949 to 1969, China saw the United States as the arch enemy. So it prepared to fight a war with the United States. But that history ended when the Soviet Union became the number one enemy. Until the late, you know, the end of the Cold War, China was not preparing to fight a war with the US. It was preparing to fight a war with Russia or the Soviet Union. And even in 1989, when the relationship was at a very low point, there was no danger of a military conflict. But after Li Denghui's visit to the United States in 1995, China began to think about some kind of military confrontation because it launched missiles to warn Li Denghui, and then the United States sent its aircraft carriers to Taiwan straight to demonstrate the US will, a willingness to participate to defend Taiwan. And I think since that time on, the Chinese have been very seriously prepared, preparing for a military or even a major military conflict with the United States. And we can see the other way around, that is, the United States is also very much alarmed by China's military buildup. So this is a very important and long-term consequence. And as a result, the PLA is also speaking loudly in defense, military, foreign policy, and domestic affairs. Not yet in military, in economic affairs. And it is becomes a political correctness in China that the larger military budget we have, the safer we'll become. It is not very popular to speak of the security dilemma, that is to say, well, we have a military build-up, then Japan and South Korea and other countries will also, you know, trying to respond to that, and so we have to set a limit to the military budget. That is not acceptable in China today. So, and another problem, I mean, another consequence of the trust, the distrust of the United States is more about China's domestic control, management of the media, public opinion, websites, as all those sensitive issues related to China's internal politics. And for instance, some sensitive words have already been deleted from some Chinese websites, sensitive words including Chen Guangcheng's name. Some even have other names involving. So then another issue is basically about the general trend of China's economics and politics. And I don't have enough expertise to talk about that. But I heard economists talk about that very much, very often. That is, when the US-China relationship was not so deep-rooted, and I so much worried, not so much disturbed by tensions. That was, for instance, in the 1980s. China was headed for more reform. And the first reference was the so-called Four Dragons in East Asia, Taiwan, Singapore, South Korea, and Hong Kong. And then people say we should learn from Japan, the Japan model, government and the business relationships. But economists say that at that time, the ultimate model was the United States or Europe. That is the typical and almost ideal market economy. And that was one of the reasons why China tried very hard to join WTO and other international economic institutions. And that was where China was headed for, in the 1980s. Although the Chinese leader didn't say so, didn't say that the United States provided the example. But there was a clear consciousness that if China wants to do economic and political reform, there are some references in the West. But today, where are these countries? The United States is, you know, is having trouble with its financial system. And its growth rate is low. Japan, where is Japan? Japan doesn't provide any good reference to China. According to some people, I still think highly about Japan. And Europe is in very bad shape. So the bilateral relationship, when it is troubled by those notions of, you know, China model versus Washington consensus and so on, the economic reform or the political reform loses sight. Another consequence that may have is China's relations with its neighboring countries. The Philippines, Vietnam, you know, all the countries I just mentioned, China's neighbors. There's a deep suspicion in China that China's, you know, problem with the Philippines, for instance, was because of the United States. It is not a China-Filipino problem. It's a China-US problem. Because the United States is supporting the Philippines. The United States is supporting Vietnam. The United States is supporting India. So we have a hard time analyzing and providing policy advice whether we should further improve relationships with those countries or we will have to make more decisive action against a country like the Philippines, which is prodded by the United States to make trouble. And China's relationships with those countries in recent years are not in very good shape. Finally, where is China's grand strategy? Although I have written something on that, I don't have full confidence that I know the answer. The best thing I can say, not the best thing, but the one thing I can say is that China is still very defensive. As I just said, you know, assertiveness versus, you know, more worries, some vulnerabilities. So I participated in a number of policy deliberations, and we never have found out the, you know, a grand strategy against the United States, saying, well, we should do something in Africa to challenge you as leader, you as influence there. We should do something in Iraq or in Syria or in Lebanon to counter U.S. influences. We have a hard time analyzing what are the American intentions, what are the American schemes, what are American conspiracies in those areas, and then protect us from being influenced by the United States. As if the United States is a shaper and we are a recipient of U.S. Action. This may not be very good for China, but this is a reality because we are in a transitional period of time. So there are a lot of contradictions. For, you know, on the one hand, we say the United States is a declining power. On the other hand, we see the United States is still omnipresent, omnipotent almost. So there are a lot of debating issues in China, in domestic issues as well in foreign policy issues. For instance, how to deal with North Korea. There are, you know, extreme views on the part of China. I mean, not within the foreign ministry or within the decision-making bodies, but in the, you know, at the political levels, there are people very sympathetic to North Korea, and there are many people who are extremely unsympathetic to Pyongyang. And there are calls from the top leadership and from foreign ministry for a better understanding of world affairs, The leadership just issued instructions to strengthen our studies of other countries of the Middle East, of Latin America. They are going to establish a lot of research centers in China, studying regional politics and the politics of different countries. That bodes well for us, for international specialists. And there are a lot of uncertainties ahead. So probably I'm putting forward more questions rather than answers to you. I think I will end up here with so many uncertainties. Thank you very much. Sure. Have I ever said so?
And your answer is yes, it's better for the United States to continuously play a global leadership role. And this is not just your view, it's also many others' view. So let me just simplify my question by asking you, are there reasons for China to trust the United States? Otherwise, if there's no reason, if what you have said are the dominant picture, how can China allow
I think there are private views and public views, even within the leadership. I think the leaders, when they see people like Timothy Geithner or Hillary Clinton or President Obama himself, the Chinese always say, "Well, I think you are better off. Although you have problems, we hope your economy will continue to grow at a higher rate, and we want to share with you our domestic problems." That is to say, China is not going to challenge the United States, and China welcomes a stronger U.S. economy. But that is not to say that these leaders will say that openly to the general public in China, for good reason. And they don't, in their open speeches, they don't make a judgment that the United States is declining power. And they simply say that we continue to welcome multipolarization. What does that mean? That means that the United States should decline to have multipolarization. If the United States is still very strong, it's a unipolar world rather than a multipolar world. So I think there are contradictions there. So we have to overcome that kind of domestic-oriented idea to have a better answer to your question. The question, to me and to many others, people in China, when we are more pragmatic, when we think about how China can get stronger and stronger, the consensus is that we have to maintain the relationship with the United States successfully. That, there's no doubt about that. And that is not going to be challenged by any leadership change. And this is the Deng Xiaoping line. I mean, Deng Xiaoping said after his retirement that he, you know, the U.S.-China relations must be better, otherwise China will suffer. So I have some confidence that despite all the troubles, despite all the distrust, the high-ranking officials and the leaders in China are still cautioning against ultra-nationalism that see the United States-China relationship as zero-sum game, despite all the troubles within China. Different voices. This question is about the U.S., right? I think, yes, I think people in the United States have different views. Those who are dealing with economic issues like Treasury Department and so on, they do think that China must be dealing with these economic and social issues more successfully. Otherwise, they cannot do better trade with China. But there are some others who focus on a specific area of interest, like human rights or civil rights. So there are very different voices in the United States. And in China, we see the same picture. The economic decision makers get along quite well with their counterparts in the United States. But it is sad to say that the two intelligence communities do not cooperate with each other. So it is a very complicated picture. I mean, on the part of China, there are many ideas about how to strengthen international financial institutions and regimes and mechanisms. And one thing that should catch our attention is G20. China's leading the way, at least it is, you know, the Chinese hope that they are leading the way in strengthening G20 as a viable international forum, at least. So China feels that it is now in the center of global stage, especially in economic and financial matters. So this is not a zero-sum game. And in this regard, I think the Chinese has more trust of the United States and Europe and Japan, because they all want to have economic recovery, and that is in the best interest of China. But the hesitation is whether China will invest more in Europe, for instance. And China is, I think it is very sure that Chinese companies want to move to the United States to invest something here. But then they will have the problem of mutual trust. And the Americans are suspicious of China's state-owned enterprises, especially when the enterprises are interested in your your oil, your natural resources, and whether this cooperation will generate more jobs in the United States is another question. So in this regard, we have to be very forward-looking. That was my view, and that still is my view. That we have to face the reality. That is, we have mutual suspicions, and then we have some structural problems. And unless and until we have some kind of showdown, some kind of negative contact, where we realize how serious the problem can become. I'm not looking forward to any crisis, but some kind of crisis may clarify the situation. For instance, in 2001, we had the EP3 incident. And the two sides immediately calmed down, although there were some more discussions. The G.W. Bush issued a very assertive statement, and Jiang Zemin returned by accusing the United States and so on and so forth. But then the two governments had to sit down and quietly solve the crisis. And there has been no such crisis since that time. I'm not looking forward to something like that. But in recently,
South China Sea.
I was just going to mention that the Philippines and had a problem with the Chinese surveillance troops and so on and so forth. And so we suspected, people in China suspected that the United States was giving moral and political and even military support to the Philippines. Then the U.S. was forced to make some kind of an announcement. They will say privately to us people like myself that the Philippines were not listening to the United States. And the intention of the U.S. is for the two sides to calm down, to solve their problem peacefully. The United States is not taking a position on territorial disputes between the two sides. So things like that, I think, we'll pave the way for some better understanding of each other. Like the South China Sea, and the North Korean issue is another example. The North Koreans they said they were launching a satellite, and it annoyed both China and offended both China, Beijing and Washington, D.C. And China, was somewhat sympathetic before the launching of the so-called satellite. But after that, the two countries are now working together against further provocation of North Korea. For instance, if North Korea is going to make a third nuclear test, I think the consequence is that it would will make China even closer to the U.S. So I think that is my point. That is, at normal times when we accuse each other, nothing will happen. But in a time of crisis, we have to be more cautious against any possible consequences. People are talking about, for instance, the two militaries are talking about a possible military showdown or even a war. But what's the point of actually fighting a war against each other over any single issue? Taiwan or South or Korea or the South China Sea. I don't believe in the theory that the two countries will inevitably fight a war, because the war would be a nuclear war, disastrous to all mankind. It's a big intellectual challenge to me, because on the one hand, I see myself basically as a scholar, but sometimes I have to give advice to both governments in China and the United States. There's certain conflict there. When I say, well, there's a mutual distrust, I'm telling the truth, I'm telling the reality. But the response was, what's the point of telling the reality? what's the point of giving the impression that the things are not moving in the right direction? And then the next question is how to address that, how to reduce distrust. I don't know, because I know it is this in this little booklet, I give you the inner story between Ken Lippertoy and myself. Ken said, well, I wrote the introduction, and we each wrote, our perception toward each other, of each other. So you should write a conclusion and policy recommendations. I said, yes. But then after 2 or 3 weeks, I couldn't find any solution, because I thought, the more I thought, the more I was pessimistic. So I wrote the analysis part. The analysis part essentially says that there are many, many fundamental reasons for the two sides to distrust each other. So Ken Lippertoy provided the answer to it. another more academic problem is how do you define distrust, and whether this is related to psychology I don't have a solid foundation in humanities or sociology or psychology or anything like that. So I'm thinking always about Professor Kazakhstan, what he will think about this. The ideas are constructivism, or whether the reality decides on your idea or your idea will change the reality. I don't know. So I thought to myself that my intellectual power is too limited to have a good answer. But at the end of the day, I have to produce something. Xu Xin said I wrote a lot. But at the end of the day, I still challenge myself thinking about what is to write more precisely and more meaningfully. I don't know.
The year 2040,
scenarios of China firing on Indian ships to defend its sea access to natural gas. Forget about direct confrontation between nuclear power, right? We've both grown up in a world in which proxy wars, sponsored insurgencies, and a rivalry between the U.S. and the Soviet Union gave rise to millions of deaths. In that world as it develops until 2040, as the total Chinese economy exceeds the United States, demands more and more resources, more and more alliances that go with access to resources, more and more access to the global commons of the sea lands. Can conflict be avoided unless the United States gives up the temptation to make preeminence last as long as possible? Is it the moral of your story for us that we should do what we can to support an outlook of graceful decline in American preeminence as a path to peace?
I still have great hope for this. Great hopes for the United States. I'm not too confident, but I think in 2040, the United States will continue to be number one in the world. Not necessarily the largest economy, but the most advanced society. And, you know, because you have a, you know, I can talk more about my understanding of the United States, but you certainly have many, many advantages. Over some other countries. Natural resources, for instance, the land, the geographical location, and so on and so forth. China has a lot of weaknesses. Although we grow at 8% a year, I don't think that will be sustainable. And the biggest challenge to us is the environmental challenge to me. I think, you know, and also aging population, a lot of social and economic dislocations, disparities. And of course, as a Chinese, I hope that everything goes like this forever, and then we become the only global power, surpassing that of the United States, but I don't have strong beliefs in that single direction. No, human history never moves that way. Always straightforward. I'm doing a research program on China's, you know, emerging challenges to China's international environment. My basic conclusion is that the biggest challenge for China comes from functional issues like, you know, the lack of resources, energy shortage, water shortage, water pollution, demographic changes in the world that would make the world even more uneven. You know, more Africans, more Middle Eastern populations. But and China is an aging society, Japan is an aging society, that will be more immigrations, legal and illegal from the developing world to the developed world. Even, you know, China will have to accept some population from North Korea or Cambodia. And it's, you know, think about this. To me, I don't think the United States is the biggest challenge to China. But people have different opinions. And so I have the understanding from reading government documents and policy speeches. Hu Jintao and other leaders say that the most important thing for China to do at the moment is to change the economic pattern of the pattern of economic development. That is to say that the economic growth will have to be more sustainable. We will have to be more balanced. We will depend more and more on our domestic market, less on international market, and we will build also a social safety net And also we've had to be more conscious about our environmental protection and so on and so forth. So this is the daunting task. And can we expect the United States to decline and then we will prosper? I don't think that is possible. And because the declining United States will have a less of a, you know, a trade relationship with China. And together we will find some new growth points. You prospered because you had the computer and, you know, internet revolution and electronic devices and so on and so forth. If China wants to sustain economic growth, it has to invest heavily in science and technology, joining the United States and other industrial powers in doing that to have more clean, you know, renewable energy, and also we have to deal with our air pollution, water pollution, so on and so forth. But as an international relations specialist, people only ask me about U.S.-China relations, high politics issues. But it's too late for me to study all that. But I want to present a view. I think that will be published toward the end of this year or early next year. That is a book similar to Global Changes 2030. I mean, I was reading the paper, the draft paper presented by the U.S. National Intelligence Council. And they are projecting the future of 2030. And we talk about it very often, my American counterparts and my colleagues, including myself, about those joint projects, I mean, about the future. And I don't think we are looking forward to a military conflict between the United States and China, or military conflict between China and India. Because at the end of the day, I ask myself whether any military conflict can solve problems. But I don't know whether we have entered into a new age of human progress. The thing we see since the beginning of the Cold War is that there are armed conflicts in a lot of regions, but not among greater powers. I mean, social unrest here and there, terrorist groups here and there, and then civil conflict or civil wars in Africa, in Syria, in Libya, and so on and so forth, but not between nuclear countries, nuclear powers. And I'm still seeking some kind of conceptual work to explain why, but I still am under the impression that there will be no war between China and India, between China, even China and Vietnam, or China with the Philippines. Yes, we could have some kind of clash, naval clash over the South China Sea with the Filipinos. But it's almost impossible for me to imagine that China's navy and Marines will go across the sea to attack the Philippines and colonize the Philippines, eliminate it as a country. No point, no way. We have to solve the problem peacefully. Maybe there were some clashes, but to occupy those disputed areas is also unthinkable. And this is not simply because of the willingness, I mean the goodwill on the Chinese side or the goodwill of the Filipino side, but it is China's overall interest. Because if we did that, there would be overreaction from the United States, from Japan, from other Southeast Asian countries. So if we are prudent, if we use our reason, we will not do that.